offering, loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We welcome you, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari. For the past few weeks, we're going through the discourse that Swami delivered on the 1st of June, 1991. And in this entire series, we're going through the 1991 Samukho series. This particular discourse has been retranslated. We had Brother Sunil give his voice for the translation. We've gone through about half of the discourse. If you've been following us, this discourse is titled Spiritual Discipline. And Swami speaks about sadhana. What are we supposed to look at when we take to a spiritual path? What should we do as sadhana and what should sadhana do to us? And that's what Swami speaks about. And as all discourses, very, very beautifully, Swami speaks of certain complex esoteric concepts to start with, but eventually now Swami has come down to what we have to do about it in everyday life. That is the point we are in, somewhere just past the midway in the discourse. And before we give you a summary of what Swami said in the clip which we played last week, and before going into the clip for this week, let's ask Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
As we were going through last week's clip, Swami began speaking about a very beautiful analogy that he gave about when you rear a garden. He said there are thorny bushes and there are flower-bearing plants. And he said that each one has its place. If used appropriately, even thorny bushes can be useful. But where they are not supposed to be growing, you do not foster them. So Swami was saying that how you can use discipline, how you can use certain methods to ensure that it benefits you. We were giving examples of how you try to avoid certain people, though you know that you're supposed to accept everybody for what they are. But if you are not in a mental state to interact with certain kind of people with certain negative approaches, to start with, you avoid them. So you are using a quality which you are supposed to discard eventually, but you use it for a purpose of going over, transcending that limitation, in a sense.
Correct.
And then Swami was, the other beautiful analogy which Swami gave was about how we deal with seasons. He said summer and winter. Nobody asks the question of how do we change the summer, right? Of course, we've managed to make summers hotter and winters colder through our actions, but that's a different thing. But Swami says that most of us accept that as a reality. It is a warm day, or is it a warm month? It is a cold part of the year. We accept that reality and then we deal with it instead of trying to fight against that. So Swami was saying that in the same manner, you have to accept that there is good and bad in society and you internally prepare yourself to deal with them. Right? That was one point which Swami made last
week. Yes. And one train of thought that started off, you know, later, as I was thinking about what Swami was saying, in the entire time we were discussing about how other people are thorny and, you know, that when you look at society, right, there's a mixture of good and bad. But supposing we were to turn that lens upon ourselves and we see that essentially the psyche that we are, the personality that we are, there are agreeable parts and disagreeable parts, right? Which, so then the question is like, how do we deal with that, you know? So I thought it is a very nice thing that to begin with, you don't fight with that aspects of yours. Like, say, you know, somebody who is lazy, right? And we see that there is a lifelong struggle that they undertake, like, you know, they try to come out of that laziness. But as you know, what happens is they make efforts for some time and it works and then they're back to being lazy, right? Like, it's kind of so imprinted in their psyche. So is there a way out? Is there a hope for people who are lazy than to, you know, function in, you know, like you have to work like everybody else does, right? You have to produce results. Then the question is it possible, right? And that is the reason why people are fighting their laziness. An inherently lazy person would be fighting his or her laziness so that they're able to deliver in their place of work, right? But the question is that approach, you know, like, will that produce results? That is where you fight your laziness and then you produce results, or you accept that you are a lazy person, totally be comfortable with the fact that you are a lazy person, and then, you know, what happens after that? Like, so what I've seen is, like, you know, many people, they adopt this approach, you know, they find some ways, you know, have reminders or something like that, which is actually more effective.
Right.
And so they either they tell somebody, you know, like, you call me at such and such time and make me do this. Right. You find that people like that, where they were totally comfortable with the fact that laziness is so much part of their psyche. Right. And then they don't fight it, but they find other workarounds around that. And people like that are able to produce better results or even comparable results with less stress, you know, than the person who's fighting that laziness.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, especially about managing a team. There was a very interesting quote that I read sometime back. He said, it says that give your toughest problem to your laziest team member. You will find the quickest solution.
Yeah,
because he wants to get done with it and, you know, go back to his lazing around. But that's a way of, you know, in a team, you have different kind of people.
Yeah.
So you use them to get the best output out of the work which you have.
That's right.
But, I mean, at the same time, not to give the impression that be comfortable with what you are and just live with it. The thing is, I think what Swami was saying is, you accept that there is good and bad.
Yeah.
But if your role in that situation is to probably fight against the bad, or if your role towards this is to try and transform which is bad, or do something which is in a manner of aiding the good over the bad, or whatever it is,
right.
At that time you accept what it is, but still you work towards what has to be done.
Correct. Because, of course, when we say that, you know, it's always predicated by the fact that the person is wanting to get out of that loop called laziness, right? They know they want to deliver, or they have to deliver. They're desirous of delivering, but there is something about them that is, like, they feel some kind of inertia. Right? So how to deal with that, right? So one, there are two approaches, definitely. One is to fight with yourself and, you know, force yourself to go do something. And the other is, like, you know, you create a structure where you have somebody who becomes like a nuisance in your life. You know, say, do this. But you've given that person the leeway, right? Or reminders or some structure where you get, you're able to cope with it rather than fight with it. Like, so, I was just thinking later, you know, that thorny bushes are within us too. Like, we're not all rosy, right? There's thorns in us and there is rose in
us. In fact, going back to that same thing, you know, Swami starts the discourse when he defined sadhana. He said sadhana is nothing but transforming bad to good and transforming pain to happiness or bliss. And that's precisely what Swami says, even in this part where you're telling, he said, during tough times, first accept the situation and then make efforts to get rid of the sorrow.
Right.
He said, so the effort to change what is, I mean, if it has to be changed, it needs to go on.
Yeah.
Probably it's a very subtle thing that, you know, that is very much the essence of spirituality. You try without wanting to.
Right.
Worrying about the effect of what you're trying.
Okay.
I would always say, you know, how do you, you know, when, many times when you're leaving home and we're in a hurry, we're looking for something and you don't find it on particular key or a document or something. So I used to think, can you search for something without having the desire to find it? You know, it's almost like that. You strive without having the desire to get what you're striving for.
Yeah.
But, I mean, maybe that's where it lies, where you accept, at the same time you also strive.
Yeah, I think also, like, in Western philosophy, psychology, Carl Jung, you know, he would say, whatever you resist, it persists.
Right.
Right. So things like this, like, say you resist your anger. Like, if you're not able to come to terms with your being an angry person, then it will persist. It will, you know, like a volcano will erupt at any particular time. Right? So I think in that sense, also, this is something very useful to think about, the principle of acceptance, and acceptance of circumstances and acceptance of who you are as a person, right? Because I think the very soon after that, like, Swami, or rather, in fact, before that, Swami has made it pretty clear that, you know, the whatever the experiences that you have, even of yourself, are being created where? At the level of the mind.
Right.
And I think a lot of spiritual sadhana is therefore actually directed towards not being caught up with that experience which the mind creates, or not buying into the story which the mind weaves, right? So a lot of that, because as Swami says, you know, that this is the reality which happens only in your mind, like even at a worldly level, no? See, most of us react from that level, where we take what the mind is telling us. It's basically an interpretation of phenomena, and that interpretation, based on that, we tend to react, right? So, Swami is saying that you need not always buy into that story which the, you know, mind has created for you, right? In that case, like, then what is reality? When you're able to stand in that question as to what is reality after that. So, then Swami starts, you know, this, the rest of the segment, where he speaks about the all-pervading I.
Right.
So,
exactly.
I can lead you on to
right. I mean, the transition is so beautiful in a way. Swami speaks about acceptance. And as you're saying, the part which we left off with last week was when Swami was speaking about this all-pervasive I. The transition, the way Swami brings it, is so beautiful. He says, because the way you will come to this adjustment, or rather acceptance, is through the understanding of the fact that, you know, it is the same I, but in different sheathings, if you could put it that way. Because he says that it is not tolerance, it is not that, you know, externally putting up with the other person. You know, acceptance does not mean that. You know, you don't tolerate the other person as long as he's there, and then you, you know, sigh a relief that he's gone. Can you enjoy that person for what he is, you know, however difficult he is? Not as an individual, but, you know, it adds flavor to life. You know, a difficult person adds flavor to your life, or a difficult boss, he says, okay, there's something adding to what you're going through in life.
Right.
That sort of an acceptance. And whenever I think of this, you know, it's probably best explained through what a mother goes through. You know, a mother is having to take care of an infant, let's say. And that's probably the messiest phase of an individual.
Right.
You know, spitting out food and making a mess all over the place, vomiting and all of that. Even as the mother is caring for the child, the mother is hoping that the child will undergo progress the way a regular child is supposed to undergo. That at the age of one or something, the child starts walking. At the age of three, the child starts speaking. And then all the you know, biological transformations which are meant to happen. But that doesn't mean that at that moment as an infant, she is not enjoying the state of that child. No, she is enjoying that infanthood of the child, at the same time also looking for the growth of the child. So I think that is what Swami is saying, that at the moment, accept and enjoy what is around you, but that does not take away the fact that you're also looking for progress or change.
That's right. It's like, if you look at, you know, one example which people give in this respect is like, say, if you look at a runner, you know, like, so he's not running because he's disgusted of standing still. He's also, he's quite okay with standing still, but for him, like, running is something which he does as, you know, like, it's part of his expertise, right? But he's not running because, you know, he's uncomfortable with having to stand still, right?
In fact, going by that, you know, what Swami was saying before, that it's all in your mind how you look at it. I recall, and your example of a runner. We used to, I had a junior at college in Vrindavan. This boy was from, I think, Dehradun or one of these high altitude places. And his hobby was long distance running. Okay, and he's used to doing long distance running in that altitude. So when he came to Vrindavan, it was like, you know, he could go on. And we used to have these 10,000 meters races. So he would comfortably come first and then run about a few laps just to increase the others. And he would be as fresh as a flower. He would never feel tired of that. And we would have these things, you know, sports meet practices when we are having. We are supposed to report at 6 in the morning or 6:30 in the morning. And if you end up coming late, the punishment is you have to make 2 or 3 rounds around the ground and again report back. Right? So one day this boy happened to come late. And I think it was some martial arts training or something like that, which had to be standing in the same place and doing that routine. So as a punishment, he was told to go and make 2 rounds. And you should see the joy on that boy's face. For him, it was not a punishment, but he was waiting to, you know, probably go and take that run. So how true is that? You know, what is pleasant for one is so unpleasant for the other. And what is punishment for the other might be a welcome break for the other.
Right. Just going back, circling back to what you were saying some time ago, so this is a small conundrum, you know, that we're speaking about a very high principle called the I, the mm-hmm. Advaitic principle, that it is the same I that resides in everyone. Right? Even as Swami is saying, you know, like when you say something like, I am sad or I am happy, but different people may be saying, I am this, I am that, like, or I am a teacher, or, you know, I am a professional or an IT professional, etc. But what Swami says is, what is common to all of them is that sense of I. Right? But how do we reconcile these two, you know? So you find that in your general everyday life, there are people who are making it so difficult for you to recognize the divinity in them.
Mm.
Right? So how do you interact with people like that? And as, you know, reading one of our alumni, who belong to, I think, the third batch of MBA. And that time Swami used to interact a lot with these students. So they had the opportunity of asking, you know, questions galore, you know, which, you know, it's a very rare opportunity to ask and get answers for things that trouble us, you know, mm-hmm. on an everyday basis. So this was a question that student had, like, and the student was very steeped in Advaita, but at the same time, you know, he could see that on an everyday basis,
not
they were
to practically live that.
How to, exactly. How do you translate that concept into mm-hmm. everyday living? So he asked Swami for the mm-hmm. solution. And so Swami materialized one photograph,
okay.
which I think it is also right. displayed over here in the mm-hmm. Radio Sai studios, where you have, you know, two Swamis who are facing each other. It's a black and white photograph, and Swami facing Swami, and in two different poses. So that was a photograph which was materialized. I think Swami distributed to a handful of students who were there. And then Swami explained that this is actually practical Vedanta or Advaita in practice. So first remember that you have to treat everyone as Swami, Swami mm-hmm. said, and that includes yourself.
Mm.
Right, so you are also Swami and they are also Swami. So up to here is fantastic. I mean, that is the Advaitic idea, right? Then Swami says, now the difficulty comes when the other Swami is appearing to be behaving badly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now how do we deal with that situation? And Swami puts it very simply. He says, even at such times, you have to remain the good Swami. Right. So in one sense, like I think also in the discourses we learnt earlier, like, mm. so no matter what, you know, the world is pricking us with,
mm.
like, we got to create ourselves consistent with certain values that we hold dear,
mm.
you know, like compassion or integrity, sincerity, you know, honesty. Right. So the world may challenge us, and the world does, right? or equanimity. So we create that as like one ideal or a value that we would like to live up to. And mm-hmm. so therefore, Swami says that therefore, even if the other Swami is behaving badly, you should find the resource to always remain the good Swami.
Mm-hmm.
That was the answer that he gave. So very beautiful photograph. I mm-hmm. saw it you know,
right.
here. Like, it was part of the experience which one student had written.
Actually, I don't recall which batch of MBA it was, but
yeah.
Swami materialized that it was almost like a visiting card size, and Swami gave it to all of them.
Yes.
And all those students carry it in their wallet
yeah.
all the time. Swami
yeah.
said, always keep this with you.
Yes.
An image of Swami speaking to a Swami.
Yeah. yeah.
But I think it all starts at that, where it's not easy. I mean, we can speak about it on the radio very casually,
yeah.
seeing Swami and everybody. It's not easy.
It's.
But that is the direction in which your efforts need to be in. At least keep that in mind. That, you know, are we able to look beyond what meets our eye and look at the Swami? And it all starts with, before that, seeing Swami in yourself, as you explained. But as some of us used to tell when, you know, we used to be with Swami, it starts with seeing Swami in Swami. Right? You know, when you're interacting with Swami,
yeah.
sometimes it would be really difficult in the sense, you know, you would find that Swami is not responding to your prayers, or Swami would not respond to your pain, your troubles. At that time, when you say that you have to see Swami in a person, it means your ability to see perfection behind the imperfection. So when I say that we were not able to see Swami in Swami, sometimes we were not able to see the perfection in Swami himself.
Right.
When as an avatar, Swami was standing in front of us.
Very important point, doing things.
Yeah. We were questioning his decisions. We were questioning the people that he had chosen to, you know, do certain things.
Hmm.
I mean, all the while thinking that, you know, I would have performed better as an avatar. Almost like that. So the first journey, at least for many of us who were, had the fortune of being close to Swami, that was a constant challenge, to be able to see perfection in Swami's actions and Swami's choices and Swami's working.
Definitely, right? Yeah.
And I think being in working in the trust, you would have come across many such occasions, you know, where you feel that, you know, why Swami is doing this, and then later you realize that, you know, wisdom was there behind
the
it.
The arc is very long. As far as Swami is concerned, the story arc is like very long sometimes. So you get to see it in fullness. And actually one person who had a good fortune of staying with Swami for many years, he used to tell me that Swami always has 360 degree view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have like a very limited perception, but he said in his experience, and imagine what it was like for him having to interact on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
convey Swami's decisions, and of course, like any thinking person, you would think at that time, is this the right
mm-hmm.
way?
Mm-hmm.
I think I spoke about this earlier also once. I was in a similar predicament, right,
mm-hmm.
where Swami had given a certain direction and every professional instinct in me was telling me this is not the way, right, but I was in so much dilemma, it was written all over my face,
mm-hmm.
and that person who I was speaking about, who had the fortune of serving Swami, mm-hmm. he looked at me and he said, Hari, it looks to me that, you know, you have some doubt regarding this,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't say anything, you know, I was just looking at him like that, petrified, you know. Then he said, Hari, always Swami will give you two choices. One is the world and one is Him. And you are always safe when you choose Swami.
Mm.
Just remember that, keep choosing Swami every single time and set the world aside and you will always be safe.
Mm.
So that was the, you know, when you were saying that, you know, you seek. So even over here, like the mind is creating a certain, like a reality where you know better,
mm-hmm.
right? You can judge the situation better than Swami does.
Right.
One very good example I recall, you know, where there was one student whom Swami was being really harsh, you know, very tough with that
mm-hmm.
particular student, and he was really suffering and all that. And the warden, he came up to Swami and he wanted to intervene. You know, he said, Swami, please you forgive, don't be so harsh on him, all that.
That's the worst thing to do.
Yeah. Swami turned on the warden and asked him, what, as if you have more compassion than I have. Now that was an epic statement to hear from Swami. And that's when, you know, everybody realized, okay, the guru has to assert himself, saying that whatever I'm doing is still out of
compassion,
beautiful. Although it may not seem like. And that is a very important statement, because see, all of us devotees, we've handed over our lives to Swami.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in a sense that we have said, Swami, you take care of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires a lot of trust, that whatever experience Swami is granting you, and it is still for your good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Even if though it may not seem like.
Yeah. I don't know, Hari. I don't think we actually really plan to do that. But actually, I mean, what we discussed in the past 10 minutes probably describes what Swami was telling in the last clip.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's saying, you know, when you say, when you refer to that picture of Swami speaking to a Swami, and
yeah.
we said that it all starts with first seeing Swami in Swami, which means nothing but accepting the way our life is going.
Yeah.
You know, when we saw Swami interacting in a certain way and we said we're not able to relate to that,
yeah.
even though we're not in front of a physical Swami, for all of us, it is the way our life is going.
Yeah.
It's an acceptance of what we are going through, because that's what Swami was saying.
Right.
That the first step is you accept where you are.
Yeah.
And the second is, as you beautifully mentioned, is that acceptance of your own flaws and your own mistakes. That is nothing but what Swami was saying, that you see Swami in yourself first.
Yeah.
And the third step is when you start seeing Swami in others.
Mm-hmm.
Probably that's where we all miss out. You know, we go out into the world and say, let's start seeing Swami in everybody. It doesn't work that way unless you see perfection around you, perfection in yourself.
Right. Yeah.
After that only you can start looking for perfection in others.
Good.
I think that's where we miss out. And as we were saying, Swami leads on to the topic of why you need to, that's how the paragraph starts. He said, we should recognize the unity that exists in mankind. And he says that is how it leads to that acceptance. That acceptance of everybody as they are comes from this recognition of the oneness in everybody. Right. And Swami was speaking about how whomever you go and ask them, be it a man or woman, a depressed person or a happy person, a beggar or a prince, who are you or what are you? Every answer starts with I am. And Swami said that I am is common and that I am is the basis for everything. So we will continue from there. Let's listen to the next clip in that discourse.
One may or may not have love. One may or may not have peace. One may or may not have truth. But this principle of I is present in all, wherever and whenever we may look for it.
There is this I.
That is, God dwells in all this. There is one that is present in all, and that is this I. That I principle is the atmic consciousness. So you need not think specifically about it. This is the inner significance of the Vedantic proclamation, neti neti, not this, not this. So this I principle is present in everyone. The I present in me is present in you too. The I present in you is present in her too. And the I present in her is present in him as well.
Sir.
When you recognize this principle of oneness, there would be no scope for such disturbances. When a person hurts another, he becomes one who hurts himself. When a person criticizes another, he becomes one who criticizes himself. This is what happened when Shankaracharya visited Kashi. When a pariah came near him, Shankaracharya said, "Hey, keep away, keep away." He then said, "Whom are you asking to keep away? Is it the body? Body is inert. To tell this inert body to move away, another inert body does not have any rights. Both are inert. There is no possibility for one inert entity to communicate with another inert entity. Leaving that aside, are you asking that my atmic principle to stay away? What is in you is Atman, and what is in me is the Atman too. Which one are you asking to keep away? In this manner, an argument ensued, making reference to the body and Atma. Then Shankaracharya, having identified, declared, "The one who can recognize the true atmic principle must be the Lord established in oneness, Ishvara alone and none else." So saying, he prostrated at his feet. Then Shankaracharya had the darshan of Lord Shankara. For For the purpose of removing the wrong feelings in you, I adorned this form and came here. Thus, Lord Shankara himself instructed Shankaracharya.
కనుకనే భగవంతుడు మానవుని యందు ఉండినటువంటి యొక్క దుశ్చర్యలను దుర్భావములను దుర్గుణములను దూరము గావించే నిమిత్తమై ఏ రూపంతో ఏ స్థానంలో ఏ కాలంలో ఎక్కడ నీకు ఏ విధంగా ప్రత్యక్షమవుతాడు అని చెప్పడానికి వీలు కాదు.
Therefore, you never know in what form, in what place, and at what time and how God will manifest in order to remove from man the bad habits, ill feelings and bad attributes.
కనుక మొట్టమొదట మనలో ఉండేటువంటి దుర్గుణాలను ఏమాత్రం కూడాను ప్రవేశపెట్టకుండా సాధ్యమైనంత వరకు కూడాను మనము సద్గుణముల చేత సదాచారముల చేత మన జీవితాన్ని సార్థకం గావించుకోవాలి.
సో ఫస్ట్ అండ్ ఫోర్ మోస్ట్ బ్యాడ్ క్వాలిటీస్ ఇన్ అస్ మస్ట్ బి కెప్ట్ అట్ బే యాజ్ మచ్ అస్ పాసిబుల్ త్రూ గుడ్ థాట్స్ అండ్ గుడ్ యాక్షన్స్ వీ మస్ట్ మేక్ అవర్ లైఫ్ మీనింగ్ఫుల్. దిస్ ఇస్ ద రియల్ సాధన.
కేవలం జపము జపము జపమని కూర్చొని జపము చేస్తూ కూడాను దుర్గుణాన్ని అభివృద్ధి పరచుకుంటుంటే ఈ జపం ఎవరి నిమిత్తమై చేసే జపం?
మియర్లీ సేయింగ్ జపం, సిట్టింగ్ అండ్ రిసైటింగ్ ద డివైన్ నేమ్, ఇఫ్ ద గుణాస్ ఆర్ అట్రిబ్యూట్స్ ఆర్ ఆన్ అ రైజ్, ఫర్ హూస్ సేక్ ఇస్ దిస్ రిసిటేషన్ బీయింగ్ డన్?
ఇది కేవలం ఆర్టిఫిషియల్ జపం.
దిస్ ఇస్ మియర్లీ ఆర్టిఫిషియల్ జపం.
నిజమైనటువంటి హార్ట్ తో చెయ్యాలి.
ట్రూలీ ఇట్ మస్ట్ బి డన్ ఫ్రమ్ ద హార్ట్.
ధ్యానాన్ని కూర్చొని ఉంటారు.
People sit in meditation.
చాలా ధ్యానం లోపల కదలక మెదలక ఒక స్టాచ్యూ మాదిరి కూర్చొని ఉంటారు.
Deep in meditation, without moving or shaking, they sit like a statue.
అతను తన్మయత్వంలో ధ్యానం చేస్తున్నాడని భావిస్తాము.
We feel that he is lost in meditation.
కొంతసేపులో ఏదో ఒక మస్కిటో వచ్చినట్టు తక్షణం దాన్ని కొట్టేస్తాడు.
In some time, if there is a mosquito biting him, he would immediately hit it.
ఇది ఏ ధ్యానం చేస్తున్నాడు?
What meditation is he doing?
భగవంతుని చేస్తున్నాడా మస్కిటోని చేస్తున్నాడా?
Is he meditating on God or the mosquito?
నిజంగా భగవంతునే చేస్తుంటే ఈ మస్కిటో ఏమాత్రము తనకు తెలియదే దేహం పైన వాడినట్టు.
If he is really meditating on God, he would not be aware of the mosquito on his body.
Well, that's typically Swami speaking about meditation. How many times as students we must have heard this, because you know it's so easy to get into this idea that as a spiritual aspirant you need to sit like that, close your eyes,
yeah,
with a half smile on your face, yeah, and pretend as though you are in some sort of bliss. I think it somehow happens, most of us get into that feeling, especially you know we would see this among students when suddenly Swami would come and speak to you. Probably, you know, when we are students, we look at everybody who gets that attention from Swami and think that, oh, he must be a very spiritual person and he's getting that attention. And then one fine day, suddenly that attention turns to you. You think that, oh, I'm also supposed to be a spiritual person. And then you start putting up all of these things, pretending as though you're, you start walking with a floating movement, yeah, with your half smile and, as we would say, the head tilted as though you're in some sort of a reverie. All of this.
Yeah. And in fact, Alan Watts, you know, he has a very interesting take on this.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that, like, just as Swami was deriding, that so most ordinary people, there's nothing wrong in it, but then, like, when we sit for meditation, we assume a certain pose. So we feel that it is this process which will then take us to, like, a state of self-realization. And he says actually it is pretty inverted.
Mm-hmm.
He says that it is a self-realized person very spontaneously will sit and meditate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it is a very natural thing for a person like that to close his eyes or his or her eyes and go into that kind of mm-hmm, contemplation, right? And we tend to mimic that.
Right.
So when we look at somebody like that, we tend to mimic. A classic example, I think, would be somebody like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, mm-hmm, himself, right? So for him, it was a very natural part of his expression, you know, for him to go into ecstasy. It just, at, you know, just to hear the, say, Lord Krishna's name, and that would be enough for him to, mm-hmm, just go into an ecstatic state. And also there are so many stories of when the disciples of the Paramahamsa couldn't find him in his quarters,
mm-hmm,
they would find him in the Panchvati, And there he would be so absorbed in meditation that nobody could disturb him. But then that was his very natural expression. Nobody had to tell him that this is the particular time at which, you know, you have to go and meditate. It was his natural expression. So,
But you know, the beauty of it is not to give listeners the impression that Swami was completely against it. I recall one very beautiful incident, not an incident as such, a very beautiful scene that I recall. One of my classmates who had, I think we had just joined the university, and he was sincerely trying to, you know, do things which probably would please Swami and what Swami would expect. And he thought one of that was meditation. And very innocently and sincerely, not in any other way. And I recall when we were sitting in Kulunth Hall, and Swami would finish the darshan rounds and he would go into the interview room. He would call a group. Between two interviews, Swami would sometimes come out and come and stand near the Ganesh portico, spend some time. And in that period when Swami is in the interview room, we are supposed to keep ourselves busy by reading or basically not make any noise or chit-chatting around. So this boy had closed his eyes and he was trying to meditate. And I recall Swami came out and, you know, we would have this habit of we would start snapping our fingers, or we would wake up people who might be dozing off when Swami comes out. So all this was happening, but this boy was pretty absorbed in the meditation that he was doing that he did not open his eyes. And I still recall Swami walked right up to where that boy was sitting. And he saw that the other boys were pinching and nudging him, trying to wake him up, you know, trying to tell him that Swami is there and Swami is actually looking at you. And Swami from there signaled, no, don't disturb him. And Swami stood there, saw him for a few seconds, and then Swami continued. So it's not that Swami does not encourage such things. As you're saying, you know, it is always a question of where it comes from.
Yeah.
And in this particular paragraph, the last part of that discourse clip which we played, Swami is saying that the whole discourse is in fact about that. If you're doing a sadhana, what is it supposed to do within you when you're not doing that meditation or when you're going about your everyday work? That is what qualifies the amount of sadhana that you've done or what that sadhana has done to you.
Yeah.
This entire discourse is about that.
Yeah. So it's, I think, a very subtle point that you brought up. See, like, so just as we were saying, you know, as we brought up what Alan Watts was saying, very rightly you said it is not to deride the practice of meditation itself.
Right.
But to bring clarity to what is the kind of attitude that one must have when one meditates. Mm-hmm. Like, so there is a definitely, what the Upanishads have been very clear about is that the spiritual sadhana is not to get to some place.
Mm-hmm.
It is in fact to affirm one's place. Right? That is what I think the idea behind all these spiritual masters saying, you know, that you the idea of meditation is therefore, you know, that you already, as Swami has been saying, is to be established in that I, you know, to be very clear, or, you know, hold on to, not, we cannot be clear given that we are in a human state, but then hold on to that idea that, you know, you are not this body. Or you're not this mind, or you're not who you take yourself to be. Like, that's, which is, I think that's why, like, Swami, at the beginning of the segment, he has already spoken about the Neti principle. So in, you know, when Swami says that how the Vedas advise you to arrive at this state of abiding in the self is by the process of Neti, right? That you, so whatever the mind says that I am this, or you identify yourself as something, like I am a Hindu, or I am a Christian, I am a Muslim, or a certain profession, or the son of somebody, or the daughter of somebody, etc. So all those labels that we apply, which normally happen when we think of ourselves. And so Swami invites us to say that, okay, I am not that, I am not that. Cut them all out and see like what remains in the end.
Right.
And we'll find ourselves that pretty quickly, you get into that state of meditation, an intense calm, you know,
right.
It kind of descends upon us. And like, I think we should let Swami guide the whole, this thing. And as we were saying last time, even as Swami was speaking, like as we were listening to Swami's discourse, I got that feeling that, you know, we are being guided through a meditation, like taken from outside the circumstances, you know, how to deal with sorrow, suffering. And then Swami started speaking to us about the mind.
Right.
And that's, we've already gone like one step inside. And so we were first taught like how to cope or how to set circumstances aside. And next Swami taught us how to look at the mind itself as the source of our reactions to those circumstances.
Mm.
And then set the mind itself aside. And then Swami starts, you know, the moment we've reached that stage is where then Swami can bring the principle of I itself in front of us, because the noise has abated so much that now it is time for Swami to bring the I principle in front. In fact, again, when I was going through this discourse, I feel like, you know, it's a very important, very, very important segment. Because I was thinking of this, as we said at the beginning of this segment, what is sadhana directed towards? I think one of the main directions, as I would see, is curing oneself of that obsession with us as a person. And that is the whole of the Upanishadic or the Vedantic thought. It's all about curing yourself of that sense of being a person, that there is a person behind those eyes, right? So curing yourself of that kind of notion. And looking back, it's a common thread throughout. Because first, Swami starts with the idea of paropakarartham idam shariram.
Right.
And that itself, you know, so in the sense, like most of us, we live in our world where we are so much of our time is taken up addressing our own, you know, insufficiencies, etc. Like whatever we say, we don't have enough of, the mind says, and we keep striving to fill that gap up, you know. Not enough love or not enough admiration. We try to fill that well up, right? And so Swami offers the antidote of seva. And Swami says, you know, paropakarartham idam shariram, or that is the essence of the Vedas or the Upanishads. And then next Swami again speaks about suffering or unhappiness. And there also, that's an interesting, as we were saying, no, it suffering or unhappiness also has a very spiritual catalyzing role. And if when all is well, you know, when everything is going on swimmingly well, we actually tend to forget ourselves. You know, in like say you're out there in nature, you're so absorbed in that this thing, you're not conscious of who you are. But you know, the moment something unpleasant or unnecessary, according to you, that happens, and then you're back being so completely absorbed with who you are. Then Swami gives us the antidote for that also. He says, in this situation, you know, this is what welcomes sorrow or you know, various things that we spoke about in the previous segments, right? Again, dealing with the mind, right? So we can see at all times the undercurrent is simply this, like, how do you cure yourself of that obsession of being a person, of being a person that requires something, needs something, etc. Very interesting thread that you see through.
Absolutely.
It.
I mean, as you're saying, going from the outer layer to deeper and deeper inside, you can see that the way even Swami beautifully brings up this episode of Adi Shankara and the Chandala, you know, that episode where, going back to what you were saying about that student asking Swami that question, he said, Swami, we understand these theoretically, but how do we see that in everyday life? So literally in that sense, Swami speaks about the principle of I and the principle of I being universal and common to everybody. And then, you know, Swami takes the example of Adi Shankara, who is supposed to be probably one of the greatest scholars of that concept. You know, he is the one who has revived the Advaita Vedanta philosophy. Swami says that even he probably has some moments where he could not completely live it in the physical.
Right.
I mean, not to say anything low about him. I mean, we do it every day. Probably there's only one incident where you can pick up from the life of Adi Shankara, and that becomes an anecdote which we, you know, revisit so many times. But the beauty is, the way Swami says, I mean, in the anecdote, the Chandala is Lord Shiva come in that form, and, you know, Adi Shankara falls at his feet and he gets the darshan or whatever it is. But then Swami goes on to say, you know, in the same manner, God always assumes forms to rid people of their bad qualities and unhealthy behavior. This again goes back to what we were talking about, the ability to see Swami in others.
Yeah.
You know, maybe your difficult boss is not going to turn into Lord Shiva and give you darshan.
Right.
But if you see that, you know, this is a problem in my character, or yeah, I'm not able to be more patient, or I'm not able to be more forbearing, and this boss is probably teaching me that.
Right.
Or Swami has come in the form of this boss and teaching me that. I think yeah, that is the attitude Swami is saying that we need to develop to be able to ensure that that sadhana, what it's supposed to do to you, is actually happening.
Absolutely. Right. I think it's very important. I feel that I would want to actually read out those two sentences that Swami said, because I think that that is pretty much the core of, you know, the or the essence of what was being said till now, that God always assumes forms to rid people of their bad qualities and unhealthy behavior. So in reference to, as you said, the Shiva appearing as a chandala in front of Shankaracharya. So God always assumes forms to rid people of their bad qualities and unhealthy behavior. And Swami goes on to say, but no one can tell in what form, when, where and how he will appear. And that is you know, very, very important. I could see a little bit of mischief in the way Swami said that, you know. It is to break us out of that thing that this is an experience that Shankaracharya alone had.
Right.
And that he had the Lord himself appear. And Swami is saying, I will appear in front of you and you cannot tell in how many forms. Right. There's that story also of, you know, of an old devotee who had, you know, who had invited Swami to bhajans at his house.
Okay.
This must be in the 1950s or so. And the lady of the house, you know, she had said, Swami, you should come, you should partake of the prasadam and go. And then the bhajan was held and, you know, the Swami did not come, and they were so very disappointed that when they came to Parthi, they brought it up with Swami. Swami, you did not come, you broke your word. And Swami says, no, I did come. And you all don't remember, but I was an old man who, after the bhajans, I came and knocked on your door and you sent me away. You did not give me prasadam. Swami says, you did not keep your word, whereas I kept mine. And so it's that's why Swami says, no, you can never tell in what form, when, where and how God will appear. And there are numerous instances of devotees, especially so many stories I hear of people who are coming to Parthi for the first time. And it's, you cannot, it's like you can document that alone as a segment of miracles in themselves, where you see they're coming for the first time to Parthi, and at some place, you know, a very, like a person at just at the right time comes, helps, guides them and just disappears. And that's about the last. I've heard my own grandmother, you know, she speak about her very first time. She was hardly a 16 or 17 year old when she came, and she had no clue. She didn't know the language, anything. And she, somehow somebody had told her, there's this, you know, Swami who can, basically her idea was that she wanted to get a cure for their poverty. Somebody should bring us out of poverty. So seeking for that, she had come to Swami. And she says, you know, that there was a person who actually helped me with my luggage and put it, and that's it. When I turned back to thank, the person was not there. You know, so many such instances. So we really never know that in either in this, you know, to as a person who will help us, you know, find our way in more than one sense, right? So,
and absolutely, as you're saying, I mean, how else can you explain? There's so many new people who are coming who have these fascinating stories. In fact, it might, you might find it very interesting. A couple of days back, we had a very interesting visitor. Of course, we've not been able to document what she had to say. She happens to be the granddaughter of Heisenberg.
Oh.
She came from Germany, and she got introduced to Swami sometime in 2011-12 through some beautiful incidents, where she says she, I think she has a vision of Shirdi Baba or something, and then you know, Swami enters her life, and how, I mean, everything falls into place. After that, she knows that, you know, this is where her destination is, and that's how she had come. And she was sharing about, you know, Heisenberg during the World War II.
Wow. That is a treasure.
That's a real treasure. But, you know, that's how people keep coming. And as you're saying, you know, that is why this episode is so very beautiful. When Swami is saying that, because you're talking of Adi Shankara, who is, you know, even when Swami gives that dictum, he says, you have the head of Shankara. Because Shankara is supposed to be one who is that intellectually so rich. The concept and the philosophy of Advaita is so very filled in his head. And Swami is saying that even he was taught through experiences like this.
Correct.
To keep reminding himself that, you know, I know it in my mind, but I need to practice it in real life.
This is the person who highlighted that dictum that, you know, tasmat jagrata jagrata.
Right.
So that you have to be so very, very vigilant. And you can see the pitfall, right, of not being vigilant.
Mm.
And I think, but on the other hand, I really liked this episode because of a small little moral that it teaches us, that a master is therefore not necessarily a perfect being.
Mm.
Right? The road to mastery is not that, you know, you're born perfect, right? And you're always in that perfection. So you can slip up and these things can happen. And that's not a demoralizing thing. You know, it's not like Shankaracharya. He saw that, oh my God, after having said all these things, and I am also, you know, like, I am also consumed by the same delusion which I've been telling people. But no, he used that moment to wake up yet again.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that is what is important. You know, when Swami was saying, accept things which come to you, good and bad, and transform, I think this is what Swami is meaning. There is the example of Dattatreya which is given, you know. Lord Dattatreya says, I have 24 gurus. And he names all beings and beasts in the forest. And he says, I pick up some lesson from each one of these. In fact, one of that is, he says, a woman of ill repute. He says, there is something to learn from every experience that you undergo. That will happen if you are in that mode. You know, if you are in the mode of a sadhaka.
Yeah.
I think that is what sadhana does to you. It keeps you prepared to learn from these various experiences in life.
Absolutely.
And Swami is saying that if that doesn't happen, then the sadhana becomes hollow. The sadhana does not get you anywhere. It really reminds me of that beautiful incident which one of our lecturers narrated, Dr. Anil Kumar, not Swami's translator, Professor Anil Kumar, the Anil Kumar who used to teach us chemistry. He would tell about his father who came and settled here. I think he was one of the earliest PROs of the ashram. He served as the PRO in the ashram for a few years. And he was a person who was given to all of these spiritual activities. He would wake up at 3:30 in the morning and sit for meditation for about 2 hours or something like that. And then he would do puja to the deities as his family's rituals were concerned, all of that. And it would keep him busy for about 3 hours in the morning. And this was his routine for many, many decades. He had lived like that, in spite of being a high-ranking official in the government and all of that. And apparently one day Swami calls him inside the interview room, one-on-one, and Swami tells him, how long are you going to continue in kindergarten? Right? And this person is surprised. He said, Swami, what are you saying? I don't understand what you're saying. Swami says, how long are you going to continue with this japa, dhyana and all of these things? When are you going to come out of kindergarten? And he's surprised. And, you know, that is what probably these activities do to you. He did not react violently, or he did not say, how can you tell this, Swami? Or he did not go into a feeling of remorse, oh God, what have I done? I wasted my... No, he says, Swami, you tell me what to do now.
Yeah.
You know, I am ready to graduate from kindergarten. And he was so open to the thing. He said, Swami, tell me what you have to do, what I have to do. Swami said, stop all of this from tomorrow. And I think even that ability to stop it after decades of doing something, I mean, sticking to something, does not come easily, right? And Swami tells him, tomorrow onwards you stop all of this. And Swami tells him, you wake up at 6:30 in the morning, that much is enough. You come and sit outside your room, sit on the corridor, and every person who walks by, you know, he used to live in East Prashanti, and we know that road, how busy it is between East Prashanti and Mandir. Swami said, every person who walks by, Swami told you, look at him or look at her and say, the same Atma which resides in me resides in him too. The same Atma which resides in me resides in her too. Swami said, just do that. Right? And I mean, literally saying that you have done that preparative phase.
Right.
Now I'm taking you to the next level. And I think that's what these physical sadhanas like meditation, not to deride as you're saying, these practices, but eventually it should lead you to this stage of your ability to see the oneness and all, and your acceptance, your patience, your forbearance, all of it being born from that understanding of, you know, the I am being in everybody.
Right. And I think that's a very beautiful experience. Brings out the fact that, you know, it is the guru who can judge your ripeness. Yeah. And more, I really like that, you know, the reply which this person gave when he says, Swami, you tell me.
Right.
It's not like he assumed that, this is the, I have reached a certain end, you know,
like more
I have
graduated. I should start meditating standing on one leg now.
Right, and it's very important therefore to keep seeking Swami's guidance in this whole thing, because I feel that in that sense the spiritual journey in itself is a very unique journey, because in any other journey, say I have to meet Prem, I have to journey from place A to place B, and the whole journey Prem is not with me.
Right.
And but the spiritual journey is unique in the sense that you start from place A to place B, and that is your destination is God.
Mm.
And so the whole time actually it is God who is guiding you throughout.
Mm.
Because as they say, you know, the Guru is a manifestation of God who appears at the right times in your life as milestones to keep you going, you know, at where next. So the God is present during the entire journey, not just at the end of the journey. And the twist appears right at the end, that when you reach that so-called end of the journey, you realize that you were always that same person whom you were seeking. So the person whom you were seeking was never without you. But I think that's the whole game, you know, that of seeking. Yeah, you go through that whole experience of seeking something that is outside you only to find that it is the whole time within you.
Right. And going back to that last part which Swami was speaking, which we started with, and Swami is speaking about meditation, and are you meditating on a mosquito or are you meditating on this? Again, recall a very sweet interaction which happened when I think Swami had called students sometime in the beginning of the academic year. So there were a few new students in that group. And if I'm not wrong, this is narrated by Brother Sonam. So he was telling this that, you know, when you spend a few years in the hostel, you know that you don't tell some things to Swami, that you dare not go and tell Swami, Swami, I do meditation every day. Because, you know, this is what Swami's stance is. Swami would always say meditation, the word meditation itself, as Swami says, very lofty. In fact, there's another beautiful discourse where Swami tells this. He says, do you think for no reason the sages and saints have spent decades together trying to meditate? You think you can learn it in one day, learn it in 2 days, sit with the senior and learn that? He says, I mean, there is no point in that. Swami tells that this is just a means of concentration and contemplation. Meditation is like much beyond. So apparently this interaction which was happening with students, Swami posed this question, does anybody here meditate? Right? So he was saying that all the senior students knew that even if you do, you know, it's better to keep quiet. But there was this one young student, newcomer, who very happily put up his hand. And he said, Swami, I do meditation. And Swami asked him, you do meditation? When do you do? So he said, Swami, morning I wake up and I have bath and I do. And Swami said, how long do you do? And he was saying all the seniors knew that, you know, this guy is getting into the trap. So Swami asked, how long do you do? So he said, Swami, I do about 20 minutes. Then very casually Swami said, if you really meditate, you won't know that you're meditating for 20 minutes. The very fact that you're saying that I meditate for 20 minutes means that you don't meditate at all. So, you know, immediately this boy's face shrinks, and then Swami says, then Swami goes on to give a beautiful discourse on meditation. So Swami tells that, see, Patanjali Yoga, if you read, the last three stages leads to meditation. You know, dhyana, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Right? Oh. The last three of Ashtanga Yoga. So Swami says the final three stages are meditation.
Mm-hmm.
What you actually call meditation. It all starts with yama, niyama.
Right.
Swami says, so start with discipline. Start with control of desires. Start with interacting in the right way with the people around you.
Yeah.
So he says it all starts with that. You can't start one day, you can't get up one day and say, I want to become a spiritual person, I'll start doing meditation. You can do that, but the benefit of meditation will come only when you go through all this yama, niyama, pratyahara, keep your body healthy, start what Swami said in the beginning, use your body for the service of others.
Right.
There's no better way of keeping your body healthy.
Yeah, I think this episode really brings clarity to that entire discussion on like what is meditation and like how are we, you know, placed with respect to meditation, right? And also we should keep therefore our eyes peeled for what Swami is saying to do. You know, that is like so very important, because it is quite easy, as we observed, you know, earlier, to get so fascinated by these concepts of like Advaita, Vedanta, so the very fascinating concepts in and of themselves. but always, as we mentioned, no, Swami's direction is like, okay, now with that, what can you do? Like, what are you supposed to be doing, right? And what is accessible, practical, what you should be doing? And as Guru, Swami always keeps guiding us. And as we have seen in the discourses, it is always there. An injunction as to what you should do.
What you should
do. It's not left in the air, but you know, this is what you can adopt as a practice. And I was reminded of this one interaction, you know, some youth who had come to Swami maybe in the 90s. There was a conversation between them and Swami. And they had composed one nice little poem or a song on Swami. And they said, Swami, we'll sing it for you. Swami said, okay, sing it. And they're singing, and the words go, you know, like, Swami, we call you Shiva, like Shiva on TV, on TV. So Swami says, huh, on TV. I mean, like, yes, you call me Shiva. And then, you know, so they were saying, and in the song it goes, like, we call you Krishna, and Swami says, yes, you call me Krishna. And you call me Rama, yes, you call me Rama. Right, and they were going in that same way, Durga, yes, you call me Durga. And at the end of the song, Swami said, okay, you hail me as all these gods, but do you listen to me?
Right.
At the end, that's all thing, and they said it was
I think it was a play of words, right? Antivi. Cheppina Mata
Vintivi.
Vintivi, something like that. Yeah, play of words. Swami says, do you listen to me?
Yeah, in Telugu that flavor comes out very well. Yeah.
Right. Don't know exactly the word, but it's a very beautiful thing. I mean, wonderful that you recall that. Swami says, you adore me of all of this. But at the end of it, the idea of adoration is your ability to obey what I am saying. And I think that's a beautiful thought to end this discussion with. Do join us again next week, dear listeners, for the conclusion of this discourse. As all other discourses of Swami, each one is a treasure trove by itself. You know, every time you go through a discourse, you feel that you don't need any other discourse. This one discourse is probably good enough to take you from the start to the finish line.
Yeah, we said the same thing of the previous discourse also.
I'm sure every discourse we say that, but I mean, we can't mean it more sincerely. We really mean it. I mean, as you said, that this discourse is so beautiful. It looked like a very simple discourse when we started, but as you wonderfully gave us that skeleton, it really contains everything that we probably need to know in our physical, spiritual practice. So with much gratitude to Swami, we offer our loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet. And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the Vahini Satsang, the last episode of the last segment of this week's Thursday Live. Happy listening. Do join us again next week, 7:30, for Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam.